think a man's voice at two atmospheres would sound kind of low pitch, and you said they sound normal. And I vaguely remember we concluded that they're running at either two or three atmospheres. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, roughly 60 feet, so I always say half a pound for every foot of water down. So you get down 60 feet, you're looking at, 30 psi. That's roughly two atmospheres. You know, we run 14.7. So, yeah, but I mean, this guy that was talking, 100% normal, so excited about the mission going on. There was nothing unusual about his face or trouble, that's for sure. I mean, this guy sounds perfectly normal.
Sure does sound like they are using some form of fancy air mixture to make that happen. And I think you say they dwell in that atmosphere for something like 2 weeks at a time. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, I think this it was a 12-day mission. Yeah, and they're going to duplicate going out to asteroids and all, and, you know, what kind of equipment they will work and what's not going to work. You know, they have it down to science. You know, with the water and all, they can duplicate what it's going to feel like actually walking on an asteroid. They weight them down to a certain weight. They have what looks like spacesuits on. So, these guys are used to wearing spacesuits anyway, most of them. So, that's what they're going to be doing. And Steve Squires is down there with them too. He's the guy that was in charge of operation of Spirit and Opportunity, the Martian rover. Down there again. He was down there on 15, and now he's down here on Expedition 16. So he must really like it. Back to you, Dick.
This is Nemo Expedition 16. Is that what you're saying? Wow. Now, I can see how they can simulate underwater the right amount of gravity, but still, the astronauts, by the way, 30 pounds per square inch increase is a total of when you start off at 15 and you end up at 45 altogether, that's a total of three atmospheres. That's a lot of pressure by my standards. And I'm pretty sure their voice would sound funny. And in space, everybody runs at a low pressure, not at a high pressure. If you had to run the suit at a high pressure like that, you'd run into some serious engineering problems. So they're doing this underwater experiment to simulate gravity, but not simulate the spacesuit or the air. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, they'll probably keep the same pressure that's in the habitat. And yeah, on board the space station there, I believe they have it 14.7, and then sometimes they lower it down to 10. Space shuttle was always around 10. PSI bases themselves, the earliest bases used to be, five, and now they've gotten it down to almost three. The lower the pressure, the better it is. You know, it's very hard to move around those suits for the astronauts. And by the way, the Chinese call themselves taconauts. You know, we have the astronauts, and the Russians have the cosmonauts. Chinese are the taconauts with a T. So I've heard that many years ago when they first started back in 03. Back to you, Dick.
Any idea what taconaut stands for, Paul?
Yeah, that's the word for astronaut. I think that's about the only Chinese word I know.
Okay, take your word for it. Alrighty. We've had our space report, we've had our Mel's Corner, and one of those YouTube videos that Wes was recommending we look at is a very nice demonstration of a transverse wave and a longitudinal wave. A sound wave is a longitudinal wave. In other words, the pressure variations are in the direction of propagation in a sound wave. whereas in an electromagnetic wave, the you could say the voltage of the wave is moving back and forth, left and right or up and down, at right angles to the propagation. That's why it's called a transverse wave. So one of those videos makes that stuff nice and clear. There's also another one of those series of videos that the guy shows you the Lenz's law, and Faraday. He calls it the Lenz Faraday or the Faraday Lenz law. And he gives an example of what happens when a magnet is dropping through a tube. And I think I sort of figured out how that one works. Lenz and Faraday, one of them tells you how much voltage you get on a loop of wire because you are changing the magnetic field through the loop. And the other guy tells you the direction of current flow is such that it tries to stop the change of the magnetic field. His way of wording it is that Mother Nature doesn't like change. And so let me do an experiment. Right back. I wanted to see if the machine was back to normal operation on 2585.
KC2QIQ.
Oh, go ahead, Glenn. And by the way, Glenn, give us a few words about how long you were in China and how warm was it. When did you come back? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. I want to wish you and everybody else on the net today a very happy Father's Day. Yeah, I just got back from Hong Kong yesterday evening. Flight got touch ground at about just a little bit before 11 o'clock, and boy, it was warm. It was 90 degrees over there, 90% humidity. So it was pretty warm, but the good thing is the air conditioning was working great just about everywhere I went. But I did have some time out on the street and did a little bit of shopping and looking around, a little bit of touring a little bit on the first day I arrived and just before I left and came back. So it was a very, very interesting time, and have quite a bit of things to say if you can fit me in a little bit later. But a very, very interesting and very informative trip, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Give us some words right now, Paul. Here we go. Glenn, I had a question. It went out of my head. Go ahead, tell us what it was like, Glenn.
Yeah, what kind of happened, Dick, was that I was very apprehensive about this trip, mainly because, you know, it's a long trip over there, and I hadn't been there in a while, and, you know, I guess some of the things that always concern me, you know, making trips like this, about, you know, what are the accommodations going to be like, what is it going to be over there, and I was really very much impressed with the new facility, because my company's actually changed its manufacturing facility over there to a new one in Shenzhen, Dongguan province, just over the border in China, going over from Hong Kong. And I was just so impressed with how strong the economy is over there. And the accommodations were absolutely fantastic. And I would say in a period of about 5 years since I was in that area last, I was just so impressed with, you know, how built up everything is. And it's just absolutely amazing. The size of the buildings, the Victoria River, every business that you can imagine, especially in electronics and technology, is over there now. There's certainly no unemployment over there, that's for sure, Dick.
Right now in China, it is 10 o'clock in the morning. So if you've slowly shifted over to China time, this is not quite midday for you, and you're going to have trouble going to sleep tonight. Is that true, John? Here we go, Glenn.
Yeah, well, it is interesting. It does take me a couple of days, really, to get back into the swing of things again. But one of the advantages are I can sleep on the plane. So generally what happens is when I leave at like 6 p.m. Their time, it's 6 a.m. here. So basically coming back wasn't too bad because I kind of slept on the plane and then just got up maybe a few hours, like 4 hours before touchdown. And then you coming back to about like 10 o'clock at night, 10, 11 o'clock at night. So when I came back here, then I just kind of like went to sleep again and then just got up this morning. So I pretty much had the full day to hear today. I'm just about getting tired now.
Does the plane go from, it flies from where to where, and roughly how many hours from here to there, Glenn, go ahead.
Well, the nice flight on Cathay Pacific is from JFK directly to Hong Kong, and that's about a 16-hour flight. But the flight that I took going there, which was because of last-minute booking, I had to fly out of Chicago O'Hare. So I had to add on, it's about the same time from O'Hare there as it is from JFK. It's about the same 16 hours. But just because I couldn't get the flight that I needed when I needed it, I had to take the trip to O'Hare. But coming back, I had the nice flight, basically right from Hong Kong directly back here, 16 hours. It's a long time on a plane, though, Dick.
Wow. I think you're telling me, except for a little bit of ground time, it's almost 16 hours of continuous flying. Wow. That's enough time where you need a change of clothes and to wash up and whatever. That's an awful long time by my standards. Can you imagine a pilot who does that particular run day after day? It must seem to him like he's just living his whole life in the air. Back to you, Glenn.
Since you're off of Sierra, Sierra.
And to ASS recognized, but the that flight actually, there's very few planes that can actually do it, Dick. I think a 747 even has some difficulty making that trip. The 777, HDS, or the extended distance plane, is the one that, that you have to take, because this way they don't have to refuel. They can do it in one shot. And I think they have two sets of crew that actually fly that plane. So, one's on rest time and one flies. So it's not one flight crew that actually does that flight. But, yeah, it is a long one. It really is. So that's really the downside of going there. I'm going to pass it back to you, Dick, first, and then I guess you can pick up the other station. KC2QIQ.
Very fine, Glenn. Greg, and to ASS, have you made that trip? Over to you, Greg.
Actually, I did, and I just wanted to throw a quick comment out there. I think in the wintertime, they take a different flight path, because it sounds to me like with his flight, I went from O'Hare also, from here to O'Hare, and then straight across. And then from there, I went to the Philippines. But they didn't go straight across the water, where I think they did in his case, to make it in 16 hours. With me, they went up and over Alaska. We were overland the entire time. We never went over water. It was amazing. And I was looking down at the mountains in Alaska, and I said, why are we flying so low to the stewardess? And she said, we're not. The mountains are that high, which amazed me. I didn't realize that. And we flew up and over the mountains on the way there, and then straight across the water on the way back. So I'm assuming he must have went over the water both ways. And that's all I wanted to throw out there. Maybe he had a comment on that. Back to you guys, and I'll be clear. I'll listen out.
Yeah, let me ask you this, Greg. The different path they take winter versus summer, I'm guessing because of where the jet stream moves around, and you don't want to be going against it. That would really slow you down. When you went over land in one time and over water the other time, in both cases, was it roughly 16 hours of flying? Back to you, Greg.
You know, it did seem about the same. Well, it's hard to tell. We kind of got diverted in the middle. Something happened on the way back. I think it was supposed to be the same amount of time, but something happened. There was a storm somewhere, so they landed us in Georgia, and all this other stuff happened. So that kind of messed everything up. So I really can't even give you a definitive answer on that. I would assume it's got to be quicker across water, because maybe, like you said, the jet stream might be going that way, giving you a little tailwind behind you, up and over Alaska and down. Maybe they were using that, and then when we came back, we went straight across the water. Same, 2 weeks later.
Well, did you fly over land, both going and coming, or was one of them over water, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Yeah, I was alluding to that a little bit in the earlier conversation, is that the 777 plane, the Boeing 777, is one of the few planes with extended range that can fly directly over the polar ice cap and do it in one shot. Some of the other planes, they can do it under the right conditions, but like you said, if there's a wind current in the wrong direction or something else, so what they do is they tend to fly over Anchorage, and Anchorage puts you just enough way where if they decide that they have to come down and refuel, they can. Because in those long flights, like you said, if they get caught in the wrong wind in the wrong direction, they have to take the safe route over Anchorage. But the 777, it's got enough fuel in it, they can actually do a direct without any trouble at all.
When you fly almost over the pole, or at least over Alaska, you're flying through some really rough territory, high mountains and so on. If you run into an engine problem there, life could get a little bit complicated. Of course, you didn't want to think about that at the time. The trip itself, were you there to set up new manufacturing facilities for your particular organization, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, this particular trip, what's happened is we have a lot of new products that are basically ready to release, and a lot of them are due with the LED products and LED drivers and other equipment. So because it was such a vast array of things that had to go over at once, I had to be over there on this for this particular trip, which I haven't had to go over for a lot of the other ones. You know, there's a lot of other people that can actually make the trip. But what was interesting was releasing all these products, and the last time I was there, it was a different facility, although they've changed and upgraded and went into a newer one since I've been there last, and it just really was amazing to me of how built up everything got and just how clean everything is and the facilities. There's new, brand new trains. I was shocked that just in Hong Kong alone, the subway system and the trains, how advanced they are now. I mean, I was just, it was just even returning on the return flight, when there's a place called Hancock, Kowloon, in the middle of Hong Kong. And the train is maybe, if you had to take a cab or a bus or some other form of ground transportation, it's maybe been an hour from the airport. You can take the train, 20 minutes tops. You can check your baggage in at the airport, Dick. It's beautiful. You just check your baggage there, and it makes right on, and you get your ticket in the train station, and you're all ready to go, actually. And you can let your baggage go and do some more shopping in Hong Kong, and come back later, hop on the train with just your e-ticket and maybe some little carry-on or something, and then just take the train and make your flight later in the day. It's just set up so nicely there, you can't believe. What a difference in just, let's say, like 5 years.
The identification tag they put on your baggage, of course, they've got a three-letter code telling you where they're going from, to, and so on. They probably also have a barcode that can be read. And I was told at one time that some of the tags being used on baggage also have radio frequency identification. Did you see anything along those lines, Greg? There we go. Glenn?
You know, I couldn't tell either way. I mean, most of the tags that I've seen put on are usually ones with the glue on the back, and they just, you know, I believe they've got barcodes on them. I think they scan them, but I'm not sure if there was any RFID. When I took the tags off and I came back here, I think they were just paper tags. But that may also depend on the airline. I'm not sure. But this particular airline they work very, very closely with American Airlines. So going into the Pacific, it's called Cathay Pacific. Very, very nice airline. All the planes are new and really generally very, very nice accommodations, especially in business class. You know, as in the 777 is a really nice plane also.
Now, even though the tag may look like it's pure paper, the fact that it's so flexible and it's got a barcode on it, if you look at it real carefully, I wonder if there really was an RFID tag built into that piece of paper. I know that at one time there were some airlines in Hong Kong using RFID tags on baggage.
Okay, I'm holding the tag in my hand. Is there something I should be looking for on the tag that might be able to identify it? Is it something like electronic that might be bumpy on it or something? Is there a way to identify it?
The antenna itself is a flexible printed conductor underneath the surface. You wouldn't see it. But what really makes the RFID tag work is the little chunk of electronics in the center of the antenna. And that chunk of electronics is less than an eighth of an inch square by a sixteenth of an inch high, little black chip. That's about the whole size of it. So I'm pretty sure you would be able to see the chip somewhere. You'd feel the chip in the tag if it did have RFID. So that's about the only identifier. The antenna itself would be so hidden you might not see it. Over to you, Glenn, KTRIW.
You're going to like this, Dick. I can't find the chip, but I took the tag and I'm holding it in my hand. It's a long strip about 2 inches wide and maybe a foot and a half long, and I carefully just took it off the bag, and on the back half of it says RFID, and there's like a little three-wave symbol on it, a couple of square dots inside a square. Now I'm holding it up to the light to see through it and see if I can find a chip. If you give me a second, I'm going to try to hold it over a light a little bit closer and see if I can find this chip on the tag deck. KC2QIQ.
How about, and you weren't going to look for the RFID tag. Boy, you were missing out on some really high technology. You didn't realize that all was going on over there.
Found it, Dick. It's amazing. It's sandwiched between two pieces of paper, and what it looks like is like a printout, and the antenna looks like a slot antenna. It's the spot in the paper where the dark part of the tag is actually missing.
How about that? Someday, if you had a chance and you made a photograph of that, I'd appreciate it. I've been hearing about these things, and now you got the proof positive that it really does exist. And if you knew what to look for, you'd be able to see the antennas in the baggage claim area, which are reading those things. How many pieces of baggage did you have? You got more than one of those tags, Glenn?
I have one tag, because I only checked on the one. It was a pretty monstrous bag, because I had to pack everything in there from by a little bit of shopping and other things that I had to stack in there. Four people had almost used two people to lift my bag once it was off wheels. But just to describe for you what the antenna looks like, it's printed maybe, I would say, let's say 3 inches by an inch and a half, the whole RFID area. And the antenna section, which is like a slot antenna, has the shape of something that looks like a squared off question mark.
Yep, I recognize that one. They got a zillion different antennas. And as you study them, you'll discover that in the center of each antenna, in the printed circuit itself, there is the equivalent of a RF choke. Make sure that the left side of the dipole and the right side of the dipole cannot pick up an electrostatic charge and zap the chip. Also, there's an impedance step-up device, which takes the 70 ohms of the dipole and steps it up to roughly 1,500 ohms. The chip itself is running RF-wise at around 1,500, 1,800 ohms. So there's some fancy technology there. The antenna, you're able to see it now that you know how to look for it. You hadn't seen it before. Is that because you're looking at the transparency of the tag to see the antenna, or is it very subtle in the coloring? Is the antenna below the surface? How come you didn't see this antenna earlier? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, what's happening right now is I'm looking at the tag. I mean, the overall tag that goes around the bag, usually they put it around one of the handles. As I said, it's about a foot and a half long, and there's barcodes on both sides. In other words, on one end, in the middle, it gives you your destination, like the three-letter that says, like, JFK for the airport. And what I had to do is I felt all over the whole tag to see if there was any bump on it anywhere, and there wasn't. So that's when I held it up to the light. Because, in other words, if you're looking at the tag underneath just natural light, you don't see much of anything. But when I hold it, so looking at it in a transparent mode up against the light, that's when I could see the outline of a printed circuit board that was extremely flexible underneath the barcode. But when you shine it up against the light, then you can see, like, there's a large black area, and inside of it there's, like, a slot missing. That's like the shape of a question mark, and like two like C shapes on either side of this this printed out area that looks like a little PC board underneath. But very, very fascinating. I would never have expected that there was any kind of an RFID in this tag, other than when I flipped it over and I saw the marking that says RFID on it. Then I started looking further. KC2QIQ.
It sounds like you would have missed that and you would have simply thrown it away. Is that true, Glenn?
I did throw it away. I actually, just as I was speaking to you, I walked over to the pail because I unpacked just a little while ago, and I reached into the waste paper basket and just lifted it out again, and then just brought it over here to take a look at it.
Yeah, the next thing that you'll get a kick out of is that in the United States, the tags run at a center frequency of 915 megs. Much of Europe is running on 886 megacycles. So I'm not quite sure what frequency Hong Kong is on. I know that the 915 meg region in Hong Kong is not used for RFID. It's used for cell phones. But they got things that are different than us. So the good news is the tag itself is so broadband, it doesn't give it on. You can have one design of tag. It will have, within a small fraction of a dB, the exact same performance at 886 as it does at 915. You could have some fun doing some RF experiments with that tag, Glenn. Although you'll be amazed how complicated is the wake up code, so to speak, the handshake code. What is it called now? You have to give it a particular code of on off pulses for it to say, "Okay, I'm here, and I'm ready to give you my information." Over to you, Glenn, KQLIW.
Copy, Dick N2EF.
Very good, Dick. As a matter of fact, if you're interested in this tag, I can probably get it to you. But as I'm just kind of like playing with it a little bit here, I might want to take a receiver next to it, one of the generators that I have in work in the spectrum analyzer, and see if it responds to anything. But I'm going to pass back to you, and maybe you can pick up Rich in the meantime. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, very fine, Glenn. N2EO, we heard you, and which frequency are you coming in on, Rich?
Okay, Dick, I couldn't make 2585. I think it shut down. I came down here to the ham shack for the first time in a while, and I'm transmitting on 975. Over.
Yep, I can now tell that you're on 975, 375. And it sounds like you're doing pretty well. I think you said you came home on Thursday. Barry was speculating that you might come home on Monday. You thought you were going to come home on Monday. Barry thought he was going to come home on Tuesday. And I guess to be conservative, they kept you until Thursday. Mark, one of the things that will amaze you, Glenn, is that that simple-looking tag, the chip itself in there, when you give it the right addressing code, that's the word I was looking for, when you give it the addressing code, it will then spit back to you 98 or 96 bits of information, and on many of these tags, they can go way beyond that number of bits. The barcode is only good for like 10 or 12 bits. The tag can spit back 98 bits, and some of those tags are re-ratable in the field. So in other words, that particular baggage of yours, if it was coming back to you by way of three airliners, at each individual baggage depot, so to speak, they could write more information into the tag telling you when it arrived, when it left, who handled it, and so on. Ain't that amazing how much information you can put in? 2QIQ, KQLIW.
It really is an interesting technology if you think about it, because here again, I can almost guarantee if I didn't even suspect that there was anything like that on the bag, probably nobody else over there does either. And it's just interesting that how nice and new their systems are over in Hong Kong and mainland in Taiwan. I guess they're doing a lot of experimentation with newer technology over there that normally we just don't see over here. I mean, I've seen it in just about everything else. And it's no surprise to me that if there's anything new and upcoming, that they're doing it there right now. One of the things I was doing there, even on Friday before I left, was just going along the Victoria River between Hong Kong and China, and just looking at every business that's over there, every major bank. It's incredible just how much business is taking place there. Unbelievable.
have the impression that Hong Kong is considered, by way of China, almost a separate country. They're left it alone. It doesn't have to obey the usual Chinese restrictive laws. And as such, it's a pretty good piece of evidence that something that's a little bit more capitalistic can be quite a bit more productive. I'm making some guesses here, but are you seeing evidence that that's sort of happening? Over to you, Glenn.
Dick, just to give you a heads up on this one, that's the way I was thinking everything was going to be when I got there. And what shocked the daylights out of me was just the fact that once I got over there, not only was it more free business, free everything over there, but when I went through customs, going, you know, because you have to sign in through customs going into Hong Kong, and then the following day, when I went over to mainland into Shenzhen, and then going over to Dongguan, was just how free and open business was over there. I mean, Dick, even in mainland China, you can check into the hotels. The hotels are set up like palaces now. For $100 a night in U.S. dollars, you're in hotels that would be considered five-star here. If you want to do any kind of business over there, you can just go into any one of the hotels, even in mainland, and just drop off your business card, talk to the concierge and say, I want to do business with people around here. Who are the people that are working in this industry, that industry, anything that you could possibly want built over there, and 100 cards are going to come back to you, and you'll find people from Europe, different areas of Europe, people from over there in mainland. You can network just about anything right in the hotels. you can't do anything like that here, and everything is all set up for you. You'll get in touch with banking people there in the hotel, people in the technology business, anything you want to do. Try to do that here. KC2QIQ.
It's beginning to sound very progressive. I wonder, did you have any Wi-Fi hardware with you? Possibly not. Also, is English becoming somewhat prevalent there? Over to you, Glenn, on those two.
Well, let's put it this way. The last time I was there and just seeing what's going on compared to now, that basically everyone over there speaks English. So, some a lot better than others. Especially all the young kids coming up now. I was just surprised to see the education level of kids in their 20s and their abilities and just the general attitude, the working attitude, the working ethic. It was just everything is like, you know, if you have something to show them, they're just like waiting and so eager to work and do things. I mean, compared to here, when you get all the attitude, it was quite impressive. I have to say, the whole time there, I was very, very shocked and amazed, just from all angles.
I'll give you a little bit more information about that tag. I think it's probably a Mode 1 Class 2 tag, which means that when the reader gives the correct address code and it basically asks the question, is anybody out there? Are there any tags ready to talk to me? Depending on the density of the answer the reader gets, the answer can sense that, hey, there's two tags or there's 200 tags out there. If there's 200 tags, the reader can tell the tags to go to a particular queue number, which is a kind of a random number generator. In other words, you can set up the 200 tags out there where each one of them has a given number of milliseconds of offset in its timing of its response to make sure that they don't talk on top of each other so you can read the tags at maximum speed. Ain't that fancy technology? You can tell it how much delay, how random a number to roll as to when it responds, making sure that the tags don't talk on top of each other, and you can write new information into them. And the straightforward tag is 98 bits, and you can get some that are many times that. A lot of information. Over to you, Glenn. K2LIW.
I'll tell you, what's fascinating, Vic, is just looking at the area of the tag. It's actually very, very flexible. It's well hidden between the two pieces of paper. And as I said, it covers maybe, let's say, 2.5 to 3 inches in length, and certainly over an inch and a half wide. So, it's nearly paper thin, the tag itself. But you can see with the amount of area that there's some room on that strip to do some things. So Very, very impressive.
Have you yet recognized the little black dot of electronics that's in the center of the antenna of the tag? Or is that possibly hidden by the opaqueness of the antenna and therefore the dot itself? I think you're saying you haven't felt it and you haven't seen the dot that's really doing all this work. Over to you, Glenn.
I would say that right now, that because of the opaqueness and because it is sandwiched between two pieces of paper on either side, that it's probably within the thickness of all that material. So it's not any thicker than any other standard tag, but I would say that if there's the little piece of electronics inside there, it's so thin it's hardly noticeable. And maybe if we're under a much, much closer inspection, I might be able to find it, but certainly not just by looking at it under regular light, if you know what I mean.
Now, you intend to bring that into the salt mine and squirt some RF energy at it. There's almost a zero chance that you'll be able to light that thing up. It's looking for a very specific addressing code before it comes alive. In other words, the normal procedure is that the reader will give it a burst of RF energy to charge its capacitor, rectify it and charge its capacitor. That becomes the temporary battery that runs the chip. After that, it needs a certain addressing code to say, yes, I am a valid reader. This is not just a random chunk of RF like somebody walking by with a cell phone. There's a particular number of bits that have to be sent to it in a particular manner so that it recognizes the fact that there's a real reader out there, and then it's ready to begin the handshake procedure before it starts dumping its data. So the chances of you getting that protocol right are less than one chance in a thousand, as I see it, Glenn, without using a real reader. And maybe you've got a real RFID reader somewhere in your factory. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Well, that's a possibility, but the interesting thing is that I'm just wondering whether if I would just take RF energy and see if anything reflects back. That's what I was... it's not necessarily the coding, but just to see if anything would reflect at the... at the residence of the antenna someplace without any additional codes.
It's not easy to judge that, Glenn, because everything reflects. In other words, every single object that's in the room with you right now at 860 or 915 megacycles has a specific radar cross-section, amount of reflection, with or without the electronics that's there. What the electronics does when it's been properly addressed is that it modulates the impedance at the center of the antenna. By modulating the impedance, it modulates the reflectivity of the antenna. And it does that at, let me pick a number, a 100 kilohertz rate. Now, the 100 kilohertz rate of Manchester code is the method by it transmits data. By modulating the impedance at the center of the antenna. If I had a dipole antenna, and I first terminate it with 70 ohms, then terminate it with a short circuit, and then terminate it with an open circuit, or if I terminate it with an amount of capacitance, and I change the capacitance, I can therefore change the reflectivity by doing angular modulation or amplitude modulation by modulating the reactance or the magnitude of the reflectivity of that antenna. Does any of that make any sense? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Yeah, actually it sure does, because the antenna's resonance is going to be dependent on the tuning point. So whatever is inside there that actually is modulating, that's quite unique. And I don't have anything like that at work that's going to be able to detect that for sure. But I do have some interesting optics at work, and I would like to look at the tag much, much closer just to see if there's anything a little bit more distinguishable underneath the microscope with some backlighting.
Now, you've called the tag, the baggage tag, paper. Is it possibly really, it's an exotic kind of plastic? I'm having trouble believing that the whole thing is paper. I think it really is a strong kind of... paper-like plastic. What do you think, Glenn?
Yeah, actually, I'm holding the tag in my hand, and I would say that the texture is it's got like almost like a vinyl, a very, very soft vinyl feel to it. And at the very, very end of the tag, It has the like some, you know, the glue surface that peeled off. And interestingly enough, compared to other tags that peeled off before, there was no paper tearing on the edge, so it came off very, very neatly. And it's all basically intact. There's no like paper ripping or once the adhesive was peeled back.
So it's a really stretchy adhesive where the tag would never fall off on its own, but you were able to remove it without ripping the tag. In other words, you were able to make with difficulty the two glue surfaces come apart. Is that true?
It came apart not terribly. I mean, you know, it peeled off. I mean, certainly it was held on quite well. But when I peeled it off, but you're right, it's not kind of paper. It's got more of a vinyl. Now that I'm really, you know, feeling the true texture of it, it's got like a plasticky or almost.
There's a lot more technology there than meets the eye, and those particular tags that are on baggage, I don't know for sure, but I'll bet you they're in the vicinity of 20 cents a piece. And the day will come when they'll be under a nickel. Isn't that a lot of technology for the money? And they're probably manufactured within a couple of miles of where you were, Glenn Baird.
Oh, I'm sure of it, where they were manufactured. And the only thing I would probably doubt, Dick, is that you're saying that these are probably worth 20 cents. I bet you they're already at a nickel. KC2QIQ.
Over there, you're probably right. In the United States, not so true. Not yet. But they're coming down real fast. And now, those RFID tags, they're going to supplement barcodes. They're not going to replace barcodes. Each has its advantage. But if you've got a real good state-of-the-art reader, that tag will act like a transmitter, transmitting 98 bits of code of information, and you can read that at close to 30 feet away with a 1-watt transmitter. The actual reader is a 1-watt transmitter, sends out enough information, enough signal, that the microwatt, let me think now, minus 15 dBm is 1 milliwatt, minus 10 dBm is 100 micro. It's getting a few microwatts of power, and it uses that few microwatts of power to run its battery, run its electronics, and talk back to you from 30 feet away. Ain't that amazing? And by the way, do you know what the frequency accuracy with which it transmits back to you are going? I probably asked you this question once before. I have some fun with people on this one. What do you think is the frequency accuracy of the transmitter on that tag? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Well, because it's an antenna, I'd say probably 0% error, because it's going to reflect back basically whatever's transmitted towards it, and it's just going to react to the whatever the principal signal is.
And to exceed?
It's got zero frequency error, with no crystal on board, no frequency determining device on board of any kind. It's using your signal that it modulates and sends back to you. And the good news is that there's no frequency error. The bad news is that it is a CW radar. The transmit frequency and the receive frequency, carrier-wise, are not even 1 hertz apart, assuming you're not moving it and creating some Doppler. So it's only looking for the 100 KC modulated sidebands is what the reader is looking for. And that's what the tag modulates in either angular or amplitude in order to send this digital piece of information. Let me do a quick experiment now and see if we're back to the 2585 operation, K2LFW. Oh, yes. Looks like we're back to normal operation. I didn't realize that. And so now I guess we can go into some of the deeper stuff. I'm going to go over to John first and then Glenn in that order. I know, John, you have trouble getting into the 975-375 repeater. And because I was listening to that one directly and not listening to 8.5, because I get a time delay when I do that, and it's kind of hard to talk when you're listening to time delay. So if you were trying to talk to me, I wouldn't have heard you, and you may have tried, so you can tell me that. KC2, WGB, K2LIW.
2E0185.
And N2HC.
Oh, Dick, I can hear you fine on 975, or 375, rather, and I could have talked to you out there, but I just stayed on 850 listening to a conversation. No problem, but I could have chopped in any time I wanted to. Good evening, Rich. Welcome back.
Hey, John. I'll be making it over that. I'll just say good evening. I got your voicemail. I didn't get back to you, but I wanted to get back to you here and say thank you for the call, John.
Yep, and I was following your device that you had on the eBay, and I don't think there was any bites on it, so I was going to let you know if there was.
Rich, were you selling something on eBay?
Hey, Dick, I was selling a Collins power supply and also a KWM-1 from about 1958 with power supply and speaker.
Wow, that's a lot of hardware. What's the approximate weight of a KWM-1 now, Rich?
Oh, I don't know, maybe, they're really not very heavy. Maybe I'll take a guess and say 26, 27 pounds. The M2 is even lighter.
I thought the KWM-1 had a full high-level AM modulator in the final stage. Maybe I'm wrong.
Oh, you're thinking of a KWS-1. The KWM-1 came before the KWM-2. It was actually the first amateur transceiver ever marketed by Collins around 1955 to 1958. And they didn't make it for the ham community. It was made, it's got aircraft connectors on the back to slide into a panel. And I'm told that Gary Powers, when he was shot down over the Soviet Union in 1958, 1959,
his
U2 had a
KWM-1
on it
at that time.
How about that?
Okay, Wes, I know you wanted to open up a particular subject, and so go right ahead. N2XJN, K2LAW.
Yeah, N2XJN. Yeah, thank you for all of this information, Ben. I have so many questions, but we have a short time right now, so... I'm going to ask you the other time. I'm pretty amazed with all of this, what you said to us. Let's jump. N2HG. Yeah, I was opening the subject of longitudinal waves as those are somewhat questionable, although one of the proofs of existence of longitudinal waves is simply the conductors that consist of the two spherical electrodes, which is one is inside the other, where the magnetic field cancels and there is still displacement current. So this proves that displacement current is nothing more than longitudinal electromagnetic wave in some cases. In the other case, magnetic field might indeed play the role, but the Maxwell equation allows that possibility. I'm not going to go deep to that. But I was trying to make a connection between the Schumann effect, where one lightning in one part of the world creates a series of the lightning around the world just by the simple resonance phenomena. Then I lead with one article that I put in here to the directive beam that could be actually aimed at the angle of incidence from any part of the world and hit the object in any possible part of the world by simple reflection from the ionosphere at a certain wavelength of the frequency, which was proved at the Schumann effect. Also, talking about the energy level, coupling to the energy, or eventually analyzing the energy level of one lightning and then a series of lightnings around the world might be somehow interesting. Now, a few other things is that we're talking about being able to, from one part of the world, simply to, by the beam, to hit any object in the other part of the world. There are two speculations that could be made. One of them is alteration of the weather, which I have a pretty good article for it, and I can discuss that, and that supports the presence of longitudinal waves. And the second one is, well, it might be destruction of the Pratt Tower, possibly, might not. And eventually, Dr. Judy Wood's material might be implausible attributing here. So, if you could refer to the video that you have seen, and then we go further into it.
In the case of coupled lightning, I've seen from my satellite system where I was able to watch NASA Select during the time the space shuttle was in orbit. Well, this was 15 or so years ago. I'm describing an incident now where late at night, the space shuttle at nighttime was flying over South America, over Brazil area. A very large thunderstorm was covering up most of the country, and with their camera aimed at Earth from the space shuttle, and the camera was just doing that continuously while the astronauts were sleeping, and I'm watching the pictures that were being downloaded at the time live, a fraction of a millisecond, set off lightning bursts in many other portions of the country essentially simultaneously. In other words, the flashes of lightning looked like they were heavily coupled to each other. Let me drop. And I can think of a couple of speculations as to what's going on. The lightning burst itself sends out a lot of electromagnetic energy. And could that be triggering other clouds that were about ready to flash? That's possible. But I think a more likely thing is cosmic rays. When you have the right kind of a cosmic ray detector, you do periodically get a burst of cosmic rays from space. I see the possibility of a number of clouds that are ready to flash from cloud to ground or cloud to cloud, having a burst of cosmic rays hit the cloud and doing the triggering function.
And then you described just one mechanism of using low energy, which the cosmic ray has one, by triggering the huge energy into the action.
Well, whether or not you call the cosmic ray low in energy is not a not an easy one, because some of the really high frequency, short wavelength cosmic rays are into the thousands of electron volts, and that's what this new satellite that was put up, NuSTAR satellite that was just launched last week, is looking for the first time to those very specific rays, which, by the way, don't penetrate the atmosphere very well. So you got to put a satellite above the atmosphere to read them. So those cosmic rays are there, and are they triggering lightning is an interesting question. I think there's been some articles written on that. I don't know if that is a situation that is settled. But are you saying that there's a third mechanism by which energy is coupled by the Schumann effect in order to create correlated lightning bursts? Is that what you're saying, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW?
That's what I'm suggesting, and not only that. If the energy density is to be at one point at given time, then the impact must be felt at a particular point, not only by the phenomenon of lightning that will, due to the Schumann effect, triggers other lightnings, but I'm concentrating myself on the low energy triggering the higher energy. But then we're talking about a directive beam that could be actually delivered on purpose to any given object. What I would like you to do before I go to the heavy stuff of explaining longitudinal wave and supporting that, you've seen that video, so the people could understand how the longitudinal wave works. N2XJN.
You're talking about the video with the professor in front of a desk, in front of a classroom, using the slinky, and he was using the slinky in two different methods in order to show a longitudinal wave and a transverse wave. Is that the video you're speaking of?
That is correct. He was showing that the displacement, which is the condensation in delta T factor of the energy in motion, could happen in two ways. Whether we move it left or right, do you want? I mean, you would be able to explain it better.
Yeah. In the case of a longitudinal wave, an acoustic wave in air, what's really happening is not so obvious at the molecular level. Each of those individual air molecules, on average, are moving 500 meters per second. That's 1.5 times the speed of sound is the individual air molecules. And the spacing between the two, between the average spacing between two adjacent air molecules is 63 nanometers. You figure out the velocity and the spacing, how often do they hit each other, so to speak. And I've got to use the word hit in quotes. They don't really touch. But they encounter each other at something like at an 8 gigahertz rate. Because of the speed and the spacing, 8 billion times per second, each individual air molecule is encountering another air molecule. Okay. Along comes something like a piston. Let me drop this. A piston or the cone of a loudspeaker, which is now being moved by your electronics moves the coil in the magnetic field, and the piston moves. And the air molecules that were nearby that piston get pushed in a particular direction. And so now in the direction where they were pushed, they have a greater velocity in that direction. And so when in their normal encounter, 8 billion times per second, those air molecules, as they propagate forward, have this extra velocity. The ones that they encounter, they're going to be transferring that extra velocity to them, and that begins the kind of a chain reaction-like process by which your pressure wave, your longitudinal wave, is launched. And so it is a essentially lossless phenomenon. In other words, those air molecules touching each other, every one of those encounters loses essentially no energy, because they come close to each other, but the cloud of electrons around each air molecule has such a strong negative charge that those charge repulsion is such that they come close, repel, and move apart. No energy gets lost. The only mechanism by which, that I understand, the only mechanism by which energy is lost in a sound wave is that the sound wave really does consist of areas of compaction and areas of rarefaction, as that professor explained. In the compaction areas, you've got a higher pressure. Higher pressure really means higher temperature, PV equals NRT. The higher temperature does get radiated somewhat. So by way of the temperature variation, there is a loss mechanism of sound. It's a rather minor one. The majority of the loss mechanism is simply because the energy is being propagated in a isotropic
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
The energy spreading out from the source, the loudspeaker will say, spreads out somewhat isotropically. Therefore, it obeys an inverse square law. Every time you double the distance between you and that loudspeaker, you get one quarter of the amount of sound in watts. So, now, what's really amazing is the way the molecules of water, how close they are together and how fast they move. The water molecules are moving faster, and they're a tremendous amount closer to each other by something like 1,500 to 1 ratio. And so the mechanism of transferring sound in water is a little bit different than it is in air. But those are both longitudinal waves. You really can't launch a transverse wave in air. You could, but it's not going to propagate very far. And the longitudinal wave that you launch in electronics, electrical engineering, it doesn't propagate anywhere near as well as the transverse wave. So air favors longitudinal, RF favors transverse, is one way of looking at it.
But I have a little bit slightly different opinion.
Okay, let's hear the other opinions.
N2XG. Well, at first, for the audience to understand,